Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Helen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And our guest today is Brendan Daisley. And Brendan is a postdoc in the University of Guelph, but he's also the president of our Student and Fellows Association here at ISAP. So Brendan, you're very welcome onto the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
What I'm really interested in today is a fascinating topic, probiotics for bees. Tell us something about bees that we don't know.
Something you don't know. Well, most people, you know, think of bees and they think of honey, and some people may think of pollination. And I'm sure based on the last decade or so, most people think of the declining bee populations. So the whole idea for probiotics for bees is to improve the health of bees and prevent population decline. You know, it's a far stretch from sort of using probiotics in humans to using probiotics in bees. So I guess a little bit of background of how my research ultimately led to that direction was I was researching how probiotics in humans could decrease absorption of toxins in the diet, such as heavy metals, mercury, and things like that. So I did my PhD studies under Dr. Gregor Reed at the University of Western Ontario, and we were really interested in how, you know, consumption of probiotic yogurt and probiotic supplements could reduce pesticide and also heavy metal absorption from the diet. So the linkage to honeybees came with the pesticides, because pesticides are used all across the world. They're in our food sources. They're also in the food sources of animals. And honeybees being very closely, you know, interlinked with the agroecosystems across the world, they're exposed to really high levels of pesticides. So we found these few strains of beneficial lactobacillus species, and we found that they could help detoxify certain pesticides in using models in the lab. We used actually fruit fly model to validate some of these things, and then ultimately validated it or tested it in honeybees in the field. And we found the same thing could happen, is that, you know, supplementing these hives with probiotics could reduce the toxicity of pesticides to them. And we also found something else out really neat, is that probiotic supplementation in bees could also improve their resistance to infectious diseases. So a lot of these, you know, that may not be surprising in human medicine, you know, the way that probiotics are used traditionally, but this was a really novel finding in honeybees, and it offered an absolutely untouched realm of possibilities of how we can improve honeybee health through supplementing these beneficial bacteria.
So Eric, your enthusiasm for bees is coming across. But when you think about bees, what is the organism? Is it the colony or is it the individual bee? Do you regard a bee as just like a cell in the body or as an organism in its own right?
Yeah, I mean, bees are so fascinating. I obviously look at everything from a microbial aspect, but I get, you know, a dose of the other side of things every time I interact with beekeepers and other researchers studying more macroscopic things. And the colony level effects versus the individual level effects is, I feel like that's an entire topic of its own. I don't personally, I think that they're a super organism. They're a super organism that is a biological entity in itself, but they're also a super organism in the sense that each individual has a microbiome of their own. So something that a lot of people don't realize is that honeybees, as a eusocial species, so humans are also a eusocial species, they uniquely have a gut microbiome that's very, not similar to ours, but they have a core microbiome like humans. So this is not common in insects. Most insects have just, you know, environmental bacteria they picked up along the way in their guts. And honeybees have this core defined microbial community in their guts that is seen across the entire world. There's very similar microbiome phenotypes. You know, the enterotype study in humans way back in the day said that humans had three different kind of phenotypes of microbiome compositions. And honeybees, the same situation happens. You know, depending on where you go in the world, they can have different phenotypes in terms of, you know, different species that are there, but functionally those microbes are doing the same thing and they're pretty consistent across the entire world.
And Brendan, with many organisms, rats, mice, perhaps even humans, you can generate a germ-free offspring. I would guess that's very simple with bees. Is that the fact?
So let me tell you that they're not as easy as you may think to make derive germ-free. And I've done mice models and I've done Drosophila germ-free. There's obviously difficulties in both that. Making the honeybee germ-free is a lot more difficult. No one has been able to do it yet. There's a few complicating factors. One of them is the collection of eggs laid by the queen. So you need to collect the eggs in the field and then get them to the lab quickly. And then you have to, you know, sterilize them with ethanol and bleach steps. And then basically, you know, place them into a media that they can feed and ultimately grow. I've tried this a few times without success myself. The eggs just simply won't grow after I've done the sterilization steps. So I haven't refined the best way to do it, but I haven't seen anyone else do it in the literature. People will basically, they call them microbiota depleted bees. And some people have mistakenly called them germ-free, but they're not. Basically, when the honeybee goes from their larval state into their adult state, they go through a period of pupation, and they actually, all of their microbes, they void them, and they have a really high immune system activity, and it essentially clears out 99.99% of the bacteria in their guts. So they're not completely germ-free, but they're pretty sterile. So when they come out into their adult form like that, people have done tests on them and everything like that, and their social behavior is significantly affected. So I think that was kind of the point you were getting at, is like, you know, do they have behavioral defects? And yes, they do.
You know, the sterile eggs can't germinate or hatch, whatever the correct term is. Do you think that microbes might actually be integral to that process, play a role, be involved in signaling, or is just the processing of the eggs renders them unable to hatch?
Yeah, I think that potentially they have a really intimate relationship with microbes, given their social structure and also how tightly packed they are and how much physical contact they have with one another in the hive. I think they need these microbes. We're still doing studies, you know, in the honeybee research field, but in other bee research fields, they've actually shown, for example, stingless bees. Researchers in South America have shown that stingless bees will not pupate. So they won't be able to transition into adult form without the presence of certain fungal species, which produce a steroid like hormone that essentially triggers the pupation process to happen and for emergence into adult form. So it's really cool because, I mean, that this is an absolutely, you know, cutting edge kind of research. This stuff is just being found out, you know, last year or the year before that, and we're finding out all sorts of new things about how microbes essentially enable life in bee species. And one thing that I'm studying that I think is really important is the effect of pesticides. So pesticides not only are toxic to bees, they have unexpected or unanticipated antimicrobial effects. And these antimicrobial effects can act similar to antibiotics, right? So we know that over the past 50 years, there's been a transgenerational depletion in human adapted microbes from the widespread use of antibiotics. And I think the same thing has been happening in honeybees and probably a lot of other species, animals in the wild, basically transgenerational depletion from antibiotic exposure. And the real problem with it is this is the regulatory agencies aren't tracking the antimicrobial potential or properties of pesticides, because they're classified as an agrochemical to control pests, and for that reason they don't require any screening or any testing towards microorganisms. Completely overlooked. So that's something I'm trying to study, and I'm trying to bring to the attention of at least Canada and the U.S. Regulatory agencies.
You draw some very interesting parallels between the kind of threats posed by the pesticides and by antibiotic usage and also by like nutritional stresses from like loss of habitat and how those impact bees. But you've drawn parallels to how that's similar to the threats faced by other organisms, including humans. And you've explored the use of replenishing the microbiome or trying to supplement the microbiome to make it a barrier or something to help robustify against those threats. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts in that regard? The use of the microbiome as a way to robustify us against these larger threats.
Yeah. So we know that supplementing beneficial strains of bacteria can improve bee health and can improve resistance to different infectious diseases. And what we think is that replenishing the microbiome of strains that may be missing, essentially from exposure to pesticides, may also be able to offer benefits to their health. At the current time, we don't know always what bacteria are missing because there's been no good baseline studies done. So things like the American Gut Project and Earth's Microbiome Project and things like that have done a really good job at kind of baselining the human microbiome and other areas in the environment. But there's nothing been done for honeybees. So we've actually just launched this year the Canadian Bee Gut Project, and we're sampling honeybees all across Canada at different time points throughout the year because we know that there's seasonal effects in microbiome composition. Essentially, we're gonna sample them over multiple points and over multiple years to determine a baseline of what is normal. And also, we're going to use the metadata collected from this large-scale survey to link potentially microbiome composition with colony loss. So we're going to sample the bees, and then we're basically putting these QR codes on the hives that beekeepers will scan when the hive either lives over winter or dies, and they report back to us, you know, that exact time when they found the colony had died or lived. And we're going to use that data over multiple years to correlate which microbes are associated with colony loss and which microbes are associated with colony survival, and hopefully develop a composition or a formula of microbes that we can use as a replenishment or a replacement therapy or intervention.
Just figuring out the specific microbe, if you don't understand the functional, what's being done by the ensemble is really challenging.
Well, human microbiome science, Brendan, people have gone to, the Hadza tribe to determine what the ancestral microbiome was in humans. I assume there must be areas of the world where pesticides have never been used, and yet you can find bees. Is that true? Can you look there to see what the evolutionary ancestral microbiome of bees should be looked like?
Yeah, you can. There are certain places. We're trying to sample those places where there's not much pesticide exposure so that we can make informed comparisons between sort of, low risk areas versus high risk areas. We're working with organic beekeepers in different areas of Canada to try to sample how different, practices in beekeeping and also farming impact the microbiome structure. And we're trying to get those samples that have been the least disturbed. But the problem is that honeybees are traded and imported and exported all over the place. They're on every continent in some area, and it's hard to distinguish their past exposure. It's really hard to track that sort of thing. But I do agree that, looking at kind of these unexposed, ancestral microbiomes in honeybees may be really interesting. I think the long-term tetracycline exposure could be particularly problematic because honeybees have a intracellular endosymbiont. You may have heard of it before, Wolbachia. So Wolbachia is really fascinating bacterial lineage. It's an alpha proteobacteria. And in my opinion, it kind of acts like a secondary mitochondria almost in their cells. And so nowadays, it's hardly found in honeybees across North America, at least. And one of the reasons for that could potentially be from the use of tetracyclines to control other infectious diseases in honeybees, such as Penicillium larvae, which causes a disease known as American foulbrood disease. And so this chronic exposure to tetracycline, it could have cleared or could have, essentially eliminated this valuable endosymbiont in their lineage. And it's really fascinating too, because if you take a insect models such as Drosophila or fruit flies in the lab, the way you actually cure them of Wolbachia is three generations of exposure to tetracycline. It's almost there's a lot of linkages in honeybees that would make sense of how potentially the farming practices and the beekeeping practices have cleared them or eliminated these beneficial microbes in them.
You've also figured out strategies to address American fowl brood by not just working with the fruit fly model of the honeybees, but also you've done trials in bee hives themselves. Can you talk about that, like just even the delivery of the intervention, how that's done? And it's not, you don't really go to the point of giving the dose to each individual bee, you instead make a patty. So I'm kind of curious about those experiments you've done. They're very intriguing.
Yeah. So dose delivery mechanism in bees, in my experience so far, is equally, if not more important than what you're actually supplementing the bees with. So you have, you know, the most amazing probiotic ever. And if it's not delivered to the hive right, you're not going to see an effect. And I think that a lot of the kind of negative studies or the studies that have found no result, they're doing it sort of wrong, or they're killing the bacteria in the process. So delivery mechanism is important. The first way that we tried was supplementing the bacteria in this thing called a pollen patty. We call it actually the bio patty. So, you know, it's basically a pollen patty infused with the three beneficial strains of lactobacilli that we've been working with over the years. And we use this patty first to test the effects against American fowlbird, like I mentioned earlier. So American fowlbirds is, I always like to draw kind of similarities to human diseases, especially for this audience that may know, you know, be more informed about the human medicine side of things. So C. difficile in humans is a spore-forming bacterium. It can be present in the gut, but it doesn't always cause problems, right? So Penicillium larvae is a spore-forming bacterium in honeybees, and it's almost always present in the hive, but it doesn't always cause problems. And we don't know what causes this, you know, all of a sudden outbreak of disease, because they can have these infectious organisms living in their hive or just in their spore state in their hive for, you know, there's some cases up to 30 years, no disease, and all of a sudden disease outbreak. So we're still trying to figure out what triggers that kind of spore to vegetative state transition, which ends up in causing disease. We don't know. I think it's personally a microbiome in disruption. But we found that basically supplementing the hive with beneficial strains of lactobacilli through this pollen patty delivery vehicle can help suppress outbreaks of disease when they happen. We got really lucky. It was serendipitous, actually looking back at it, in the timing of this study. We had actually started supplementing hives right before an infection, a natural outbreak happened in the field. We were supplementing hives just for a pure validation of safety of the probiotics, and basically to look at any potential outcomes, short and long-term outcomes. And about a week into that study, the experimental apiary we were working in had an American fowlbird outbreak. So that transition from spore state to vegetative growth in P. larvae happened. So we got a really excellent opportunity to kind of, because we had been taking samples the whole time, we got an excellent opportunity to kind of retrospectively look at this, go back, look at what the microbiome looked like, you know, what the effect of probiotics was on the immune system during the infection. Did the supplement hives survive better or worse than the non-supplement hives? And we actually found that the supplement hives had a really low level of the pathogen. They had, it was almost 100 times less, 100 fold less. So it was really impressive findings. And it would have been really nice to follow these hives along and basically see if, you know, the supplemented hives could survive the infection and ultimately, you know, the colony keeps surviving. But because of local laws here in Ontario and Canada, and they're very similar in most other places, North America and also Europe, American fowlbird is a notifiable disease. So when we detected it, we had to basically call the local bee inspector, apiary inspector, and they came along, put stickers on all the hives and said that all of the hives had to be essentially burned, not burned, but sterilized. So you essentially had to sacrifice the bees and sterilize the hives. So we had to get rid of all of the hives. And it was actually like, I mean, this was one of the first times I had done any field work in honeybees. And it was shocking to me, the extremes and severity that happens when infectious disease happens in these apiaries. And the reason for this is they don't want the disease to spread to another apiary, because once it spreads to another apiary, it spreads like wildfire, and it can affect multiple apiaries in a distinct regions and cause a huge financial collapse in the beekeeper, huge financial repercussions essentially in the beekeeping and also farming industries. Without bees, our crops can't be pollinated either. So it has a really trickle down effect that is, it can affect a lot of things. So that's why the response is so severe.
Somewhat but naively, Brendan, we had a project recently where we found a Penicillin gnat larvae, which can kill Penicillin, other Penicillin. Oh. And so we said, oh, let's get Penicillin larvae and test it against it. So we looked around and there was a lab in Italy had it. We said, oh, can you send it over, please? And it had just a storm of protests. You're not allowed to import that bacterium into Ireland. They're just terrified of it because of, here it's called colony collapse disorder, but it's the same phenomenon. And so, yeah, we were told under no circumstances could we bring this bug into the country.
So it really amazes me, and I especially when you get outside of the scientific community, when you're talking to, you know, actually people in the field working with bees and farmers and things like that, they are terrified of this disease because they don't understand it, and they know that it can cause this massive collapse of colonies, complete loss of apiaries, and also it's once they report it, their colonies are gone most of the time. That's the response by the government officials, right? So they're scared of it. And I think we have to change the narratives really in these practices in agricultural practices and starting to look at basically not all bacteria are bad too, right? Huh. When you even talk about bacteria to most beekeepers, they think of bad, they think of disease, but we need to kind of shift the narrative to like, hey, yeah, we need to maintain a balance of good versus bad versus like just using antibiotics.
That kind of brings us back to the probiotics. And Dan was asking about the delivery method. I'm more curious about the dissemination. I mean, does every bee in the hive end up colonized by the probiotic they've delivered, or do they not colonize at all? Are they transient? What's the kind of dynamics of the probiotic moving through the colony?
Yeah. So the PADI was the first method that I tried. Actually, I didn't even get to the next method. So there's two methods that we're trying. One is through the PADI, and one is through a novel spray-based formula. And essentially, it's the bacteria is suspended in an isotonic solution. PBS works a lot of time, and you can basically just pull out some frames, spray down the frames, and the bacteria get everywhere in the hive. In terms of colonization, the three strains that we use, so two of them, so we use a Lactobacillus plantarum strain, a Lacticaceae rhamnosus strain, and an AP Lactobacillus coonkii strain. The latter is derived from honeybees. The other two are derived from different sources, different animal sources or plant sources. So only one of them is actually a honeybee symbiont or has been derived from honeybees. And it does colonize to a degree. But all three strains, they get inside of the honeybee and they're present inside the gut for up to 2 weeks following supplementation. So that's post, basically when the patty's gone from the hive. 2 weeks after that, the bacteria is still detectable based on qPCR in the guts of honeybees. But after that, it slowly starts to trickle out. The AP Lactobacillus coonkii bacterium, that could stay around for longer, but we just don't have sensitive enough qPCR primers to distinguish between what's already there and what's new. So there is a potential for that one to colonize, but I wouldn't constantly say it does. But the point is that whether or not they colonize or not, you know, similar to human probiotics, the colonization isn't needed for a benefit to occur. And a lot of times, you know, proponents for probiotics want to say they colonize in honeybees, but it doesn't matter. They end up in making the honeybee healthier. And that's ultimately what we want to do. And if they don't stick around, that's fine too, because we don't want to disturb their natural microbiome. And it's, you know, if their natural microbiome can be retained long-term and these probiotics can have an intermediary effect and we can use them potentially instead of antibiotics for the treatment of these infectious diseases, we can help the bees maintain a better microbiome that is health producing over the long term.
And have you considered other parallels with, say, human or animal prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, you know, the other biotic family? Would you think any of those would work in bees? Or is there, can you even imagine what a prebiotic for a bee might look like?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Prebiotics have been studied in honeybees recently over the past, I would say, 5 years, but they don't use the word prebiotic almost ever in these studies. They're just testing different, you know, compounds in their diet naturally. And pollen, for example, from different floral sources, have a number of prebiotic fibers in them that have been tested. And it's really fascinating because these pollen fibers can actually beneficially modulate the honeybee microbiome, and it will end up producing a lactobacillus dominated microbiome in honeybees. So something I didn't touch on earlier was that the honeybee microbiome, when healthy, in a healthy honeybee, should be dominated by mostly lactic acid bacteria. And once again, this is different from other insects, which are primarily dominated by environmental bacterium, which are usually proteobacteria. You know, there's been name changes recently, but most people will recognize proteobacteria. So it's really fascinating that healthy honeybees have really high levels of lactic acid bacteria, because honeybees have a symbiotic relationship with plants. And there's been some terms developed for honeybees over the years. I don't know if you've ever heard of flying doctors or heard of honeybees being described as that. Essentially, the idea is that honeybees, when they're in a balanced microbial ecosystem, they help to disseminate these beneficial lactobacillus strains all throughout the plant and all throughout the pollen reservoirs in the different plant sources. And in exchange, the plant gives them nectar, gives them beneficial fiber to keep their microbiome healthy, and it also gives them things to, like, you know, raw ingredients to make honey. And in exchange, the bees help pollinate the plants. So there's a really symbiotic relationship on the macroscopic layer level, but also, you know, down on the microscopic level, things are also kind of in symbiosis. And it's really interesting to think about that, and also how we can, you know, going forward, how we can apply these knowledges in improving not only honeybee health, but also the health of crops, and, you know, potentially improving the yield of crops in agriculture and things like that, all without using man-made xenobiotics and different agrochemicals.
Can you finish? We have very little time, but I know you have some interesting thoughts on the parallels between honeybee decline and chronic metabolic syndromes in humans. Can you just give a rough overview?
Well, I think we've kind of touched on that all throughout, but Basically, you know, the increasing epidemic of obesity and chronic metabolic diseases in humans all across the world have been linked to, you know, loss of those host-adapted symbionts. Colin mentioned earlier, basically, in ancestral civilizations, basically, what do their microbiome look at? What does the, you know, Western microbiome look at, or the industrialized microbiome? A lot of those diseases that they're chronic diseases, and they're not necessarily all as transmissible, but they're kind of widespread. Same thing is happening in honeybees, and it's resulting in colony loss. And we don't always know why the colony loss is happening. Sometimes the colonies just die, and it's not, you know, infectious disease isn't always there, and that's not the problem. And sometimes the pesticides aren't even detectable. It's not always there. An emerging theory is that it's the loss of microbes, these missing microbes, they're missing from the colony, and which doesn't enable them to survive. And it probably leads to some sort of metabolic, you know, disorder. The colony can't function at that level anymore. There isn't enough research to conclusively say, like, you know, there are direct parallels between that and human chronic metabolic diseases, but it's a really interesting focus of my current research.
Brendan, that was really fascinating, and it's so much fun to come across, you know, the use of probiotics in a field that, yeah, I hadn't really considered them being used in, and in such an important field, because as you say, I mean, we lose the bees, you know, we have enough cataclysmic events on the horizon with climate change and everything else, but losing bees would be equally disastrous, I guess. So this, thanks to the work that you do, you and your colleagues, we really appreciate it, and we appreciate you coming on the show today. So thanks, Brendan.
Thank you so much for having me.